It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Well, good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Haw.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Kirk, execution is actually, and the death penalty is actually being reinvigorated, the debate over it anyway, especially as it relates
to... Not the actual executions?
Not the actual executions, but the debate over it. As in Oklahoma this past week, a terrible situation occurred. There was a man named Clayton Lockett who was executed. He was put to death. He was convicted of, obviously, admittedly, a horrendous crime of shooting a 19-year-old and having her buried alive. He was later charged and convicted of first-degree murder, rape, kidnapping, and robbery. There was a long legal and political battle into this whole thing. And what happened in the end was that a lot of these drug companies are no longer supplying the drugs used for lethal injection, because they've been targeted in a sense that people have boycotted these companies. They've been very angry with these companies that have done this. So a lot of prescription drug companies or companies that manufacture them have stopped manufacturing them.
Well, I believe there's also some of these prescription drugs are manufactured in countries that have an ideological or philosophical opposition to the death penalty as well.
Yeah, European countries, a lot of them are manufactured there. And so what they've had to do is many states that still have the death penalty, and there are 32 states remaining, Wisconsin not being one of them, is they've had to go to different novel sort of combinations of these drugs. And it's almost experimental in a sense, because they haven't tried many of these before, and they're not releasing the names of the companies that manufacture these drugs. So a novel combination of drugs was used on Clayton Lockett this past week, and or it may have been before that, but the news on it came out this past week. And people who witnessed this execution said that he was writhing and buckling in pain on the gurney. He ended up there was a lot of time that went by. I think it was nearly an hour, and the executioners called off
the
actual execution.
Yeah.
But he died of a heart attack.
Anyway,
and it was too late. And so they used these drugs. One was an anesthetic. Another was a drug that that stops respiration, and then you had potassium chloride, which stops the heart from working. And so they had actually pushed two and three drugs or combinations of these drugs into Mr. Lockett, and he ended up dying what many believe was a very horrendous death and situation there. But this reinvigorates the debate over executions, because since 2009, there have been three states that have abolished or voted to abolish the death penalty, those being New Mexico, Connecticut, and Maryland. And the United States Supreme Court has never declared a method of execution to be unconstitutional. They've always upheld the actual methods. Going back to 1879 with the firing squad, they upheld that. The electric chair in 1890. And then lethal injection once again in 2008 in a fairly recent case. But this is not an anomaly. There have been lots of different situations that we can point to over the past several years even where these types of drugs have caused what many believe to be excruciating pain for those involved. Now, you may think, oh, well, who cares? Because these are people who have committed terrible crimes and they ought to die that way. But as long this wasn't the intended result.
Right. Yeah, you know, and it's odd that we're dealing with this fine line, because, you know, the standard, of course, is whether or not it amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. And the Supreme Court has held that the basic fact that a state, any given state, has the death penalty, and the federal government, by the way, has the death penalty as well.
Right.
I mean, it's something that the United States implements on occasion for those types of cases where death is warranted. So it's not a universally constitutional or unconstitutional issue. In fact, it's usually an issue that is left up to the individual states to determine whether or not they choose, usually by voter input, whether or not the death penalty is something that exists. We haven't had the death penalty in Wisconsin for the majority of its history as a state. But the idea is that the fact of an execution in and of itself is not necessarily cruel and unusual. The method by which that occurs becomes the question. For many years, in the 1970s, there was more or less a national moratorium on the death penalty while individual states had to explore methods of more or less verifying that their method of execution was the most humane possible, although that isn't the constitutional standard. That was more or less what had to be accomplished individually on a state-by-state basis. But it's interesting that we're dealing with this scenario whereby let's assume that the state does have the constitutional ability to execute somebody. And if that's established, then you go on to how is it done? And is it done in such a way that is, number one, efficient, number two, as painless as possible, you know, because causing the death of somebody is going to involve some form of
pain,
or damage to the body, you know, in some way. And then number three, if that can be done in such a way that the result is virtually certain, because that's primarily what most people are interested in when they're executing an execution, is that it works.
That it works. And it,
right. Yeah. And that's why, you know, hanging has been abandoned as a method, because we're all familiar with incidents where that it didn't work the way it was supposed to. And, you know,
well, and I'm not, and by the way, I'm not in favor of the death penalty, but just to play devil's advocate, if one of the measures by which we're judging whether this is working is efficiency, then why is the firing squad not essentially the most efficient way?
It makes you wonder. I mean, because actually, it's practically certain to cause death. It'd be very unusual that it didn't. It may be a bit gruesome in terms of its implementation, but on the other hand, it does achieve a better amount of efficiency. But let me just throw this out there because it's an interesting concept. Doesn't it seem that the states that are implementing this combination, this cocktail of different drugs, is seeking to, on the one hand, you know, execute the person in such a way that it isn't violent to the outside observer, but also not too terribly pleasant for the person being executed?
Right.
Because after all, why couldn't we just pump the person full of morphine until their heart stops? I mean, maybe that would just be too much fun, you know, for the person.
It's one of those things. The U.S. Supreme Court has said with regard to the death penalty that the Constitution and the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment does not demand avoidance of all risk and pain in carrying out executions. That's what they've said. Now, what they have said is that the Eighth Amendment prohibits inflicting pain merely to torture or punish an inmate. Now, if the death penalty, though, isn't punishment, I don't know what is. And if we know that the methods by which we are inflicting this pain as punishment is causing pain on the person, then isn't there a reevaluation that needs to take place?
Right, right. You can almost see how... Well, and of course, the Constitution and its many provisions, including those that are within the Bill of Rights, are designed to be reevaluated with the changing course of political and social history in our country. There is an argument, I don't adopt this argument, but there is an argument that if we can establish that the reason that the death penalty exists in those states that have it is to mete out the appropriate form of punishment, both because it meets the crime,
right,
but also because it acts as a deterrent. If you believe that, I don't. But
I don't believe it acts as a deterrent. But even the president of the United States said, with regard to this execution, said essentially, well, he recognizes that the death penalty, there really isn't a whole lot of evidence that the death penalty is a deterrent. However, he believes that for certain very serious offenses, such as this one, pointed to, that it's appropriate. Now,
well, couldn't an argument be made that if it were more painful and if it were more gruesome, that maybe it would rise to that level where it achieves the deterrent effect people think it should have?
Yes, but if you look at the actual statistics, though, on states that have the death penalty versus don't, and states that have executed versus not, and all the statistical analysis, I think, points to the fact that this really isn't a deterrent and certainly isn't any more of a deterrent, I don't think, than life without parole, which is what we have in a lot of different situations. There are many inmates who talk about how they want to die. They want to get it over with.
Right.
That, in fact, life without parole is worse. But we have to think beyond that, I think. We have to think about Is this moral as a country when you have 144 people right now on a list that we know that were on death row at one time and now are no longer on death row thanks to people like Barry Scheck at the Innocence Project and wonderful folks who do work like that? These people were set to die, to be executed. That is one thing you cannot undo. You cannot undo an execution. You can undo a very lengthy sentence. And we've seen that, by the way. False convictions, wrongful convictions. So when you're talking about death, yes, it's the ultimate punishment. Yes, it's horrible and it's gruesome. At the same time, it's also irreversible, unlike these other situations where somebody's in prison for the rest of their life. So I think, and by the way, there's been about a 23-point drop in the last, I forget if it's 10 or 15 years, in support for the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
It's now down to about 61%.
Well, and that coincides with the mounting evidence that our justice system is imperfect
right.
in so many different ways. So it's not just a matter of if the person did the crime, they should suffer that ultimate punishment, but also the confidence we have with which we mete out that ultimate penalty.
And
there's more and more doubt in our society in terms of the reliability of convictions, and that's definitely something that warrants further discussion. But with regard to this particular issue, I guess you're going to have to find a better way to kill people. You know?
Yeah, and you know, that seems to be what we're doing, is we're trying to find a better way. It's almost come into a medical sense now, where you have these people working for the Department of Corrections that are helping out with almost a medical procedure. But it's gone so horribly wrong in so many different cases and very likely caused extraordinary amounts of pain. All right. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
Okay, Kirk. So Donald Sterling banned for life from the NBA.
Does anybody think it's odd that Don Sterling sounds a lot like Rod Serling? I mean, I keep wondering if this is the twilight zone of racism.
It is. It's very, very weird. But he, you know, he obviously made very racist, horrible comments and has confirmed that it was his own voice expressing those comments on this audio of a private conversation that was then leaked to the media via TMZ, which seems to be taking over for the New York Times as the most trusted source in news. Nah, I'm just kidding. But TMZ actually has broken a lot of stories. It's interesting. So this was a recorded conversation between Sterling and his girlfriend. And by the way,
who's
not to be confused with his wife.
Right, right. That's a different person.
That's a different person.
Right.
Who's much older than this woman,
and she is of a
mixed race
ancestry,
right? And she is, has African American. She's part African American, and so this whole situation has caused a controversy. And I'm sure everybody's heard the racist comments. We don't need to repeat those. One thing though that hasn't been analyzed all that much is this actual conversation and the recording of it. This was recorded, and it was privately recorded, and now his girlfriend is saying he knew that it was being recorded, but I don't see any evidence of that.
At one point, she was saying she wasn't the person who leaked it.
Right.
Which suggests she wasn't a party to the recording, although that seems highly unlikely.
It does seem highly unlikely. And Wisconsin is a one-party consent state, meaning that if one party consents to the recording, then it's okay. However, you still can't use it to commit a tortious act or a crime or something of that nature, because you can be liable civilly or criminally for that. But it's a one-party consent state. California is a two-party consent state, where all those involved in the recording have to know that they're being recorded. So depending now on the location of the recording, and depending whether Sterling knew that he was being recorded, it might have been recorded illegally. And if that's the case, then there could be civil or I don't know if there could be criminal liability in California specifically with regard to their laws, but certainly there could be civil liability.
Yeah, theoretically, yes.
And so I just find it, and obviously there's absolutely no defense for Sterling's comments, but
I think the real controversy here is that we're dealing with the NBA, which is a private organization, obviously, but it has a unique public presence in the sense that it's almost a highly public institution, a non-governmental public institution that has standards for membership and participation and everything else. And you know, the real issue here that I think is really not being dealt with is that, of course, we all have a reaction to Sterling's comments, and none of us like it, and all of us feel like this loser should be gone. And it's not the first time that he's exhibited an inappropriate attitude toward minorities. And ironically, he's become a very rich man because of his employment of minorities as part of the basketball trade, if you want to look at it that way. But, and I'm sure I anticipated what your view on this might be as we were preparing for the show.
Yeah.
And I thought almost certainly you're going to come to the defense of the First Amendment, because you always do.
No.
This
is not a First Amendment issue. This is not a. But what I am going to say is that I do find it troubling. First of all, his comments are reprehensible and horrible. But I do find it troubling that we have private recorded conversations being leaked without somebody else's knowledge, apparently or allegedly. And this has not only happened with regard to Donald Sterling and his racist remarks, it's also happened in the context of lots of other private conversations. Because when somebody is in their own home, that is supposed to be the point at which you have the most privacy, the most protection, the most reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right. And let's face it, I mean, this is where I thought you were going to come down on this issue, that we have to respect the fact that some people have unpopular opinions. And we have to also allow people, such as the Ku Klux Klan, people that hold racist ideals and things like that. We can disagree strongly, and we do, with those sentiments. However, holding those views in and of itself and saying them out loud in your home, you know, really is something that raises a problem. Now, my view on this is that
you don't have an expectation of privacy.
Well, no. The punishment here is one that's entirely appropriate because, again, as I was saying before, the NBA stands in a unique position. It's not as though this recording is being used in some way to slander somebody or to, you know, engage in tortious interference or anything like that. What it really is, you know, it's probably the icing on the cake for what has been a long history of somebody that probably has been implementing that view in the manner in which he's been involved in the NBA.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's say this, Kirk, and I would pose this question to every person that's listening to this radio show. Would you want all of your private conversations inside of your own home with your wife, with your spouse, with your significant other, whoever, by yourself, you're talking to yourself inside your own home? Do you want that to be subject to recording and possible release to the public? I can see if this were a situation where he was in a restaurant and exposing these views, because certainly you have I don't think you have an expectation of privacy in a restaurant if you're yelling something across the restaurant, you're in public. But if you're in the privacy of your own home and you're making deplorable, racist, horrible comments, something does trouble me about these conversations being recorded. And certainly what troubles me the most is that they were racist. But it's also troubling now that we live in an age where people are playing gotcha. And they're recording your comments, whether racist or not.
Absolutely.
Or just unpopular, all over the place, and then playing them for people.
Well, and right. And I think part of it is that, you know, the issue of privacy is one that sometimes people view in the context of, if you don't have anything to hide, then what's the problem? I'm not doing anything wrong, so why do I care? Well, you should, because, you know, respecting and maintaining that sense of privacy is the important concept. It doesn't matter what you're saying. You could be saying nothing wrong. You could be doing nothing wrong. But the fact that we as a society hold privacy, at least that which we have left, as something that we value, is something that does need to be protected. On the other hand, as long as it's not disputed that he actually said these things, I have no problem with the lifetime ban, the $2.5 million.
I don't have any problem with that either. I mean, I think the punishment is certainly appropriate punishment. I'm merely talking about the method by which this was obtained, because we have a long history of Donald Sterling, as you point out, doing terrible things, not renting to minorities, saying awful things. He allegedly said, use the N-bomb right in front of former NBA commissioner David Stern.
Right.
Shouldn't that have been a point?
Let's not forget the whole controversy here arose because of the fact that his girlfriend posed with a picture of
Magic Johnson.
Yeah. And that flipped him out for some reason.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean,
if I had the chance to pose for a picture next to Magic Johnson and have somebody take it, I would be happy about
that. Thrilled.
In fact, if you were posing next to Magic Johnson, I would be very happy for you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Because that would be very nice.
Well, it would be. And the point is that there's absolutely no defense of Donald Sterling. I mean, whatsoever.
Nobody is defending him.
But this does call into question issues of privacy in this country, because I'll bet you there's a lot more where that came from. And there's a lot of people out there who probably have made terribly racist remarks inside the privacy of their own home, and yet, you know, they haven't been exposed like Donald Sterling has.
Let me ask you this. Let's take away the recording aspect of this and just look at the fact that, you know, Sterling is a private citizen. He's not a government employee. He's not a political leader. Does he have a right to hold racist views?
Well, sure, he has a right to hold racist views.
Does he have a right to say so in his own home?
Yes.
Okay.
He has a right to say so, but does he have a right to say so publicly? He doesn't have a right to own an NBA team.
Right.
He doesn't have the right to own an NBA team.
And that's the only thing that's a little sticky about this whole situation is that, you know, what's actually happening here, and again, I don't have any problem with it because I think it is appropriate, but it does approach that line where we have to wonder, you know, the interplay between a person's unpopular and reprehensible personal views, and that could relate to anything in your life, any view that you have, any prejudice that you hold, whether you admit it or not, any sort, you know, it could relate to preferences in different types of music or sexual orientation or anything that you as a person hold as your views.
Well, how about Paula Deen?
Well, sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's situation
how
where...
She kind of walked away from that relatively unscathed.
Yeah, but, you know, she is... Here would be my best advice to people who are owning or running companies.
Yeah.
Don't express your political views because... And I know that's bad to say because we all live in this... But if you express them publicly and you take a partisan stance, don't be surprised when there's a backlash.
Right.
Because there's going to be a backlash, especially if you make racist remarks. In public. Now, Donald Sterling did them in his own home, but he had previously allegedly made racist remarks in public. So, you know, what's the expected result?
Again, I think it's appropriate for the NBA to drum out somebody that doesn't uphold the ideals of the NBA. And that's really the issue because the NBA has a very particular and honorable history of promoting a colorblind application of sportsmanship and everything, and I think very successfully over the years. And somebody that doesn't contribute to that because of an expressed view, certainly there is action. However, and this is just being devil's advocate here, and I don't believe this, but we're talking about somebody being hit in the pocketbook and also being forced to sell a team because of an unpopular but permitted view that he has. And I'm fine with that, but I can see where if that's the precedent, it could leak into all kinds of other things. What if, for example, we were talking about a scenario where there was a political affiliation by a sports organization and somebody expressed an opposing political preference? Could that person be forced to not participate in something that is, an institution of our sports world because of a political affiliation?
Perhaps they could. Well, Herb Kohl was the owner of the Bucks, and he was a senator, a Democratic senator from Wisconsin. So, but you know, this certainly, obviously, Donald Sterling's comments rise far above that situation in being extremely offensive and racist. All right. We'll be back in just a moment. More Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, op, op.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. So
Yeah, I'm Kirk.
You are. There was a... there's video going around that's viral video of a Green Bay police officer who arrested...
You've seen this video? Oh, yeah.
Who had arrested a man for disorderly conduct. Now, what allegedly happened is this gentleman's name from Caledonia is Joshua Wenzel. And the officer appeared to respond to a profane outburst by rushing at Wenzel. This was outside of a bar in the Green Bay area, early morning hours. He pushed him across the hood of a car, threw him to the pavement, and appeared to punch him one time in the side of the head. Now, if you look at the way this was going, it looks like, you know, the guy was saying things to this officer of a profane nature.
My impression of it is that he was questioning why
another person was being arrested.
Right. And of course, you know, you're really not supposed to do that.
Right.
One could say that you're interfering with or obstructing a police officer's duty. Although, you know, coming back to our First Amendment rights, you know, expressing verbal criticism
of the police
in their presence has been
upheld in many situations, unless it crosses that murky line into disorderly conduct, which, as we know, can involve sometimes verbal behavior, verbal statements.
And that can constitute disorderly conduct.
Right. But in this situation, okay, so he's 29 years old, and if you look at the actual video, I mean, it looks disturbing. It really does look disturbing.
Because he's running backwards away from the officer, holding up his hands.
Right. And he's thrown across this car, and then he's what appears to be a punch to the side of the head and thrown onto the ground. Yeah. So that you know, looks like something that could be an overreaction by this officer to this. And now there's an investigation that's going on, and the Justice Department is going to review that investigation. But there's been sort of fanning the flames, if you will, by both sides in this situation, okay? And because the Green Bay Professional Police Association essentially released a statement saying that this was justifiable, legal, and lawful. Okay, fine. That's the conclusion they come to. But that's going to ignite.
Insert your own adjective here, you know.
Yeah, right. And so then what happened is this past week, or about a week ago, about 10 gun owners gathered in Green Bay to protest the police actions, many of them carrying concealed weapons, apparently. So they were there. And they were protesting what was termed a, quote, savage attack, end quote, by the Green Bay police officer on this 29-year-old Caledonia man. You add to that there was new video that came out that was threatening the Green Bay Police Department online, warning against the city's police department. It came from somebody who was anonymous, warning that it was coming after authorities in reaction to that video. And there was the cell phone video. By the way, the reason they got the video is somebody was taking cell phone video of the actual incident, which, as you and I know, goes on all the time now.
Sure.
And so the Green Bay Police Department says that it's prepared, they say, Green Bay Police Department, be prepared for the worst. We will not issue a warning in this case. We have our operations in place. What does that mean? What are they actually going to do, if anything? The Green Bay Police Department has essentially stated, we're not worried about this, not a credible threat, but they are looking into it. So,
is this the video with all the people wearing the Joker masks?
No, this is not that. But what does this mean? I mean, this Wenzel guy has told the Press Gazette that he wasn't bruised or otherwise injured. He acknowledged being, quote, kind of drunk, end quote, but said that he simply asked police why they were arresting another person in the crowd. So,
well, and what this happens a lot, in fact, every night somewhere, you know, in our country, there are police that are dealing with when people drink alcohol, they can get unruly, their judgment's impaired, their emotions can run high. And the police are the ones that presumably haven't been drinking and are there to resolve the situation when they're called to the scene. Now, we expect officers and appreciate that officers are in a heightened state of alertness. One responding to the scene doesn't know what to expect. People could be armed. People are unpredictable. And that's all the more reason why an officer in that situation should have a cool head and be restrained somewhat. Because this not only had the potential, but actually has created an escalation of the problem. So you have a bunch of people presumably impaired or drunk standing outside a bar. The police are trying to calm the situation. They're arresting somebody, whether it's right or wrong. And then it turns into what really can't be argued is anything less than a somewhat brutal assault against somebody who was not involved in the reason the police were called to begin with, merely for questioning. Now, given that the police are usually in that state of heightened awareness and that they are there to do a specific job, which is different than the job of the citizens or the gawkers that are the onlookers with the cell phones, it would appear that good judgment would mandate that you not go punching somebody in the side of the head when you've got a bunch of unruly people watching with their cell phones recording.
And police officers have, right, policies and procedures that they are supposed to abide by. And we will have yet to see. I know the Green Bay Professional Police Association has already made their claim that this was legal and justified and nothing wrong here. But there's going to be, I believe, a further investigation into this. And probably a lot of that will center on whether he had violated, this officer had violated the police practices in the situation. Now,
Wenzel was charged.
Right. I believe so.
With an offense.
Wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. Assaulting a police officer's knuckles with the side of his head, I think. Isn't that what it was?
No. Oh, yeah. No, that was not. That's facetious. Now, this is, but this whole thing calls into question now. Everything is being recorded, and it sort of leads into the story about Supreme Court, our United States Supreme Court, considering limits on warrantless cell phone searches. We have cell phones on. Almost everybody has cell phones nowadays, and many people have smartphones that can record video and audio and do all kinds of things, and it has all their contacts, all their email, all their secrets, where they've gone, where they haven't been. Just about anything is on somebody's cell phone nowadays.
Let me just interject, because I thought of something that relates to this.
Yeah.
I know that you're familiar with that app called Shazam.
Oh, yes.
And I find it a little odd that there is a setting where it will, everywhere you go and everything you do, it can identify, you know, what music, what TV show, it's weird. It's like
creepy.
It monitors everything you're doing, and then you can say, hey, what was that TV show I was watching? What was that? And some of these are ads that are placed in there.
Oh, that's weird.
And so if it knows that you're listening to a Taco Bell ad on TV, it'll know that. And then it can utilize targeted advertising. There's all kinds of weird stuff this thing does. And you basically pick a setting that says, keep track of everything I do.
Go eat that taco.
Go
with
eat that taco.
Dorito,
like,
seasoning
why do I,
on it.
Why do I have this sudden craving for Taco Bell? Because my phone told me I do.
Oh boy, that's creepy. That's really creepy. Well, the United States Supreme Court is sort of struggling now to adapt to modern times, in the sense that keeping up with cell phones and the latest technology, and whether the laws and traditional legal rules keep up with that. The issue now before the United States Supreme Court is whether police can search cell phones without obtaining a warrant at the time of an arrest. Now, in many situations, and I think what should happen, is police ought to get a warrant before they search somebody's cell phone. Because a search incident to an arrest, which is supposed to be for weapons or other contraband, is not the same thing as a search of a cell phone, I would argue, because a cell phone contains so much more data, so much more information.
And generally, it's probably one of the most private things that you have in your possession. You know, because it reflects who you've been talking to, what you're saying. It may contain pictures. Some of them may be, you know, things that you don't intend other people to see.
To see, right. And cell phones can be downloaded. They can be kept in databases. You and I know from...
Forever.
Forever. Yeah. You and I know from dealing with cases involving cell phones that you often get, as part of a cell phone, quote, download, hundreds of pages of documents that contain all kinds of private information about people and what they're doing and where they are and who they've been with, who they've slept with. I mean, it's just, it's every single intimate detail of a person's life.
It's a treasure trove of information.
It's a treasure trove. And so, if anything...
What is a trove, anyway?
It's just a lot of stuff,
okay.
I think. Yeah, that's the technical legal term for it. No, I don't know. Justice Elena Kagan observed that a person can be arrested for anything, including driving without a seatbelt, and the police could search that person's cell phone and look at every single email, including very intimate communications, as well as medical data, calendar, and GPS information to learn every place the person has recently been. She says, you call it marginal, but in fact, most people now do carry their lives on their cell phones.
That's
and I
true.
Think that's a good analogy to
yeah,
draw.
That's true.
It is a person's it's life.
Evidence of your life, yeah.
I mean, you know, you're basically dictated. I'm dictated by my calendar. I mean, you and I live and die by our calendars in terms of what we're doing and where we're supposed to be. And
my phone tells
stuff.
Me what to do.
Right. Absolutely. So this will be interesting to see how the U.S. Supreme Court decides these cases.
Well, I think that's a very interesting issue in the sense that if we look at when that information is revealed involuntarily, when it's being seized for some reason, well, the most logical reason why that would be happening is because there's probable cause to believe you committed a crime. And if they want to look at something where it's not just a freebie, you know, not just a peek at what might be going on to see
right.
what's there, which would be a general search, which is what if we just have this blanket authority for all police officers to be able to just glance at your phone or download the data or see
yeah.
what's going on. That's exactly what the Fourth Amendment's designed to prevent in a huge way. I mean, if our founders, we always talk about the founders.
Yes.
If our founders knew that there was some way that a device that everybody carries and uses on them can reveal everything you've done, everywhere you've been, and every thought you have that you express to another person and to every person and reveals every detail of your life, and to say that the government should have free access to that.
Oh, I think they'd be horrified.
They would be horrified.
Absolutely. All right, on that note, we have to take a break. We'll be back with the final segment of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Our final segment, Casey. How does the time fly?
It flies when you're having fun, Kirk. And let's end in Missoula, Montana today.
Oh, great place to end.
Absolutely. Well, it was not such a great incident, though, that happened recently in Missoula. I don't know if you heard about this. There was a 29-year-old man and a woman in the home. I believe significant others in their own home. There had apparently been... their home had been burglarized 2 times in 3 weeks, and the burglars had taken phones and credit cards from their home. And so they set up, essentially, sensors to see when somebody would be in their driveway, when somebody would get into their garage. And they actually set up a live camera inside of their own garage to be able to monitor it, I think, like, from bed
yeah.
to see who was there. So...
Not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea. Right. So, the interesting thing comes next. They heard the sensor going off. And by the way, there was an allegation that this man who was getting his hair cut a few days earlier had been saying to the person cutting hair or whoever was in the establishment that he wanted to shoot some teenager who came into his garage. So he had set up all this stuff so that theoretically, he could do that, or so the story goes. So then the sensor goes off in the middle of the night. Someone's in the driveway, and then someone goes into the garage. The man sees the person on video inside of his garage. He goes outside with a gun, and then essentially the door was open in the garage. He starts firing into the garage and fires a number of different shots. This 19-year-old young man dies as a result of it. And so now the man has been charged with what they term in Montana to be deliberate homicide. In other words, intentional homicide or something very similar to that. Not reckless homicide, but intentional homicide. actually, I should say it was a 17-year-old, not a 19-year-old, who was shot here and killed. So this reinvigorates the debate over the Castle Doctrine and how far does this go?
Well, and then let's start with a basic point here, and that is that certain crimes should be. We should try and deter people from committing them by having laws that make things illegal.
Right.
Now, the way that that is dealt with is when someone is arrested for committing such a crime, they're entitled to a lawyer, they're entitled to the right to remain silent, they're entitled to the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, they're entitled to a public forum, they're entitled to a jury of 12 and a unanimous verdict, they're entitled to cross-examine any witnesses that would be called against them, they're entitled to subpoena their own witnesses, they're entitled to testify on their own behalf if they wish to. When somebody walks into a garage, albeit their own property, and shoots the person, well, we just bypassed all of that, and it runs a risk of chaos in our society. Now, this is a problem that I always have, and it used to be, if you go back 20 years, and there'd be a news story like this, it would be a novelty. You wouldn't see it that often that somebody, well, certainly the type of surveillance that existed back then has been improved dramatically. Homeowners didn't typically have cameras set up,
right?
Which, by the way, you can get for like $10 at Radio Shack. You know, it's not an expensive proposition nowadays. You don't have to be a drug cartel, you know, to have video surveillance on your own property.
Sure,
but it's a situation where we have to realize that when one is a victim of crime. And while the crime is occurring, what our society would prefer and something that we promote in terms of orderly justice and the application of orderly justice, you bring in the people who can be trusted to have the cool head, just like the guy in Green Bay that beat up the...
Except maybe he didn't have such a cool head.
Except that he didn't.
Right.
Aside from that point, he didn't. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
The emotions run high. You feel violated. You're angry. You have and here's the problem. And here's the interesting problem. The reason why he's being charged with a premeditated act is that it had happened before. And he knew to expect this possibility and had thought about what he would do, presumably.
And his alleged statements to others about how he wanted to shoot somebody if somebody comes in.
Now, that's an understandable sentiment. It might be an extreme sentiment. It's not one that I would have. I would say, well, if someone's going to keep burglarizing my home, I'm going to have 911 on speed dial, you know? And I'm going to be prepared to call the police right away. On the other hand, if one feels repeatedly violated in the sanctity of their own home, here's the point. Emotions are going to run high. Your sense of being violated, your sense of injustice when you're not getting, presumably, the help that you would like from law enforcement, that all contributes to we as imperfect human beings handling instruments of death when in an emotional state and a tragic consequence. I would suggest that no one would disagree with me if I were to say, and I'm about to, that burglary of this nature does not warrant the death penalty, right?
Correct.
Okay. So if we start with that presumption and then go beyond that to say, why would there be some exception to the law to say that you can gun down somebody who's committing a lesser crime? And I don't mean it's not serious, but I mean the person was not killing somebody else, the suspect.
Yes.
He may have been committing an illegal act, and it may have been one that caused a personal reaction from the homeowner. But on the other hand, aren't we just bypassing everything that we hold sacred to our justice system?
I can say this. I understand why we have – I believe very strongly in self-defense laws, and I think there's a good reason that we have them. In this situation, he's going to have to prove that he believed reasonably that his life was in danger, that he was either going to suffer great bodily harm or death. And he's going to have to prove that he believed that. Now, there could be a lot of problems with this case.
Well, that's just a self-defense type situation.
Self-defense,
but
right.
Couldn't it theoretically also be something along, like you said, the Castle Doctrine, where you don't have to believe those things necessarily?
Well, except for, I think, in Missoula, if somebody's committing a forcible felony,
yeah,
which is what this would be, into this home, then you have the right to protect yourself. But you can't just go shooting willy-nilly. That's why they've charged him. I mean, why they've charged him with this offense.
Right. But we're in a gray area. Because you don't just have the right to protect yourself. You have the right to protect your property and others.
Yeah.
Okay? And states that have an expanded view of the Castle Doctrine includes just the defense of your property.
Well, since 1947 in Montana, they've had the ability to defend structures that are occupied, by the way. They have to be occupied structures.
Right.
But, you know, and if a garage is attached to your home, then certainly that would be different than sort of an outbuilding that's not attached to your home.
Here's the point. You know, the guy is the guy probably overreacted. Fine. People do that. That's what we do as human beings. We all expect that we're not perfect, right? We live in an imperfect world. We're not robots. If you had a robot with a gun that was able to do a logarithm in its computer head and then shoot when only mathematically appropriate, that would be wonderful, I suppose. But then again, we'd live in a world that's even more Big Brother than we do now.
Right.
But we're putting somebody in a situation where the law tells them two different things. One, don't kill people. Number two, hey, use your own judgment that if someone's invading your structure, and if it's occupied, and if they're committing a felonious act with force, which burglary is theoretically that, right?
Yeah.
Shoot them. That's, you know, there's at least the idea that the law permits that. And whether it does or doesn't in a particular situation means we find somebody who may have believed he was acting lawfully, but wasn't. And that comes down to, I mean, and why? Let me ask you why we're even dealing with this situation to begin with. Because the dude had a gun. And if he didn't have a gun, he wouldn't be facing murder charges. One might argue that he might be dead, too. But on the other hand, he probably would have, you know, he wouldn't find himself in this situation.
Well, we don't know. And because he says that he heard while the other person was inside the garage, he heard the clanking of metal. And he didn't know what that was. And he thought that could have been a weapon. It could have been a knife. It could have been a gun.
Well,
he didn't know what that was. It could have been anything.
It could have been R2-D2.
But we do talk in terms of what a reasonable belief would be in this situation. And you're right. It is complicated. And I don't think there's an easy answer to this. But what I do know is we've had self-defense since essentially the beginning of our, I mean, this goes back long, long time, many years before the United States was ever formed. I mean, self-defense is something that we take very seriously and should take very seriously.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's all that self-defense in and of itself.
Well,
it's not all that controversial.
I get that. You know, one has the right to defend themselves against force with, you know, a reasonable amount of force. But it's the fact that we have all this subjectivity, you know, as part of that analysis. And I'll tell you, although we do respect self-defense as a concept within our law, those that exercise self-defense usually get charged, and they have to prove their own innocence because of their subjective state of mind.
Right.
It's a bad concept in terms of us being, you know, I believe, or I would at least like to have the right to live an orderly, law-abiding life. It's just something that I think we're all entitled to, that if you choose, you can obey any and all laws. And that's something that I believe I have a right to do. So I should know what those laws are, and I should know whether my conduct is in or out of that sphere of legality.
Well, there have been lots of defining of these laws, and I'm sure we'll get more, Kirk, so there'll be plenty of stuff that we can cipher through on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey, but we do have to end the show for the day. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. It's been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a wonderful weekend.